New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in many of the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu. You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the new Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hi, I'm Leanne Whitney, guest host working alongside host Jeffrey Mishlove, co-host Emmy Vadnais, and my other colleagues here at New Thinking Aloud. Today, I'm excited to welcome Swami Savapriyananda to the show. Swami Savapriyananda has been the minister and spiritual leader of the Vedanta Society of New York since January 2017. He joined the Ramakrishna Math in 1994 and received sannyasa in 2004. He also served in various capacities in different educational institutes of the Ramakrishna Mission in India and as the assistant minister of the Vedanta Society of Southern California. He has been invited to speak at several universities across the world, including Harvard University. He's played a prominent role in organizing and participating in various interfaith panels and seminars, including speaking at the World Parliament of Religions in Toronto in 2018 and at the United Nations headquarters in New York. Some of Swami Savapriyananda's popular talks have been compiled into ebooks, Who Am I?, What is Vedanta?, and Dissolve into Infinity. In this episode, Swami Savapriyananda and I discuss several aspects of Indian philosophy, including pure consciousness, knowledge, illusion, and intuition. Swamiji is joining me remotely from his office in New York, and now I will switch over to the internet interview. Swami Savapriyananda, welcome to the show today. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for having me, Leanne. It's great to be here.
Wonderful. I wanted to start out with Vedanta itself. If you could give our audience a broad definition of Vedanta, or even a concise definition, whatever feels right for you, for those people who haven't been exposed to Vedanta yet.
All right, I'll do both. A concise definition first, a precise technical definition, and then a broader definition. Both are helpful, actually. So the term Vedanta has two parts, Veda and Anta. So Veda means, it refers to the ancient scriptures of the Hindus, the foundational texts of Hinduism, which are the Vedas, the four Vedas. But also it means knowledge, just means knowledge. Veda means to know. And Anta means the end or the highest point or the final point. And therefore, when you put Vedanta together, it's like the culmination of knowledge, that the final teachings of the Vedas. So Veda Anta would be the final spiritual philosophical teachings of the Vedas. The definition we always memorized when we started studying Vedanta in a traditional Sanskrit teaching system, is Vedanta Nama Upanishad Pramanam. Vedanta is verily the source of spiritual knowledge called Upanishads. These Upanishads are texts found within the Vedas. So the Vedas themselves are vast, and they contain lots of stuff on ritualism, many things which are obsolete. Even in modern Hinduism, nobody refers back to those things now. They are Hinduism has evolved past many of those things. But the Upanishads are parts of the Vedas which are really foundational to Hinduism. So those Upanishads taken together, they form the textual basis, the foundation of Vedanta. So precise definition would be, literally, Vedanta is equal to Upanishads. Now, there's another text which is very important to Vedanta, which is very well known. Everybody who studied even a little bit of Hinduism always has come across the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita is actually a text of Vedanta. It is a concise and practical presentation of the teachings of the Upanishads by Krishna to Arjuna. So the Bhagavad Gita. And there is...
Song of the Lord, right?
Yes, if you literally translate that, it means Song of the Lord.
Yeah.
Then the third text, which is foundational for Vedanta, is a sutra literature, which is Brahma Sutras, the sutras on Brahman or the sutras on the ultimate reality. And so these three taken together, the bunch of texts called the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Brahma Sutras, these three taken together form the textual foundation of Vedanta. They're not equal. The Upanishads are primary, and the Bhagavad Gita and the Brahma Sutras are derivative. So that's the precise definition, the heavily textual kind of definition of Vedanta. The broad definition of Vedanta would be, I suppose, the spiritual philosophy of Hinduism. When you come across Hinduism, you see a bewildering variety of practices, images, iconography, mantras, deities, techniques. But at the back of them, there is a philosophy. And generally, that philosophy is Vedanta. We can go deeper into it. These things always need to be qualified. But when you come across living Hinduism, if you go to Hindu communities, people who are practicing some form of Hinduism, you will generally see in the background there is one or the other system of Vedanta. And yes, I just want to add that Vedanta is not one system. Based on the Upanishads, based on the Gita, and based on the Brahma Sutras, multiple systems or schools of thought have developed over the centuries, over the millennia, actually. My home tradition is one such school. It's a very well-known school of Vedanta called Advaita Vedanta, the non-dual Vedanta. But I want to emphasize that there are very different schools of Hinduism, of Vedanta. There is the dualistic Vedanta, multiple schools, actually. So, yeah, that's the short and concise definition and the broad definition, which would be in a sort of general philosophy of Hinduism.
And in that general philosophy, so Brahman is this pure consciousness. Maybe you could give us pure consciousness, the absolute God, but not a dualistic God, are often translations of Brahman into English.
The word Brahman in Sanskrit etymologically just means the vast. It just means the vast or the limitless. Brahman means the vast. Now, yes, as you said, it has multiple meanings. One meaning is actually the dualistic God. So in the dualistic systems of Vedanta, Brahman would refer to the closest would be God in theistic religions. So a personal God with all the omnis, you know, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, a loving God, a God who listens to prayer, a God who is the creator, preserver, and destroyer of this world, the cyclical theory of creation and projection and absorption. So basically the God of religion. That is what's definitely one meaning of Brahman. But the school which we are going to talk about, the non-dual Vedanta, in that Brahman means specifically or ultimately pure consciousness or pure being. So the ultimate reality of the universe, of ourselves, of everything is supposed to be this Brahman, which is being itself or existence itself or consciousness itself, bliss itself. Often the formula Sat Chit Ananda is used. Sat meaning pure existence or being, Chit meaning consciousness or pure awareness, and Ananda meaning bliss or pure joy. Yes.
So in a sense of embodiedness, there is a sense of embodiedness even in the definition.
I wouldn't say so. When you say God, there's a sense of personal God. But when we say Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, notice the emphasis is on pure being, pure consciousness, pure bliss. Now, what do the words pure refer to here? Pure, not in the sense of a good or a nice. It just means not an embodied being, but being itself.
Yes.
Not a particular conscious experience, but the background consciousness which makes all conscious experiences possible. Bliss meaning not a nice feeling, but that which makes all happiness, meaning, purpose, value possible. So one way of looking at it would be, you know, in philosophy, you have these three deepest questions, the three major branches of philosophy. There's metaphysics or ontology, which studies What's real? Is God real? Is the world real? Is matter real? Is mind real? So what's real? What's reality? And Vedanta would say reality is Sat, being itself, existence itself. The second branch of philosophy, which is primary, it studies knowledge. How do you know anything at all? Epistemology. And Vedanta says all knowledge is possible because of consciousness, Chit. And the third branch of philosophy, where a lot has been put together under one umbrella, is nowadays they have a new name for it, axiology. It includes value, what used to be called ethics, what used to be called aesthetics, all of it put together, the beautiful and the good and the meaning of it all. And Vedanta says the goal of it all, the meaning of it all is bliss or fulfillment. So one way of understanding what Satchidananda is, it is an answer to our most profound questions. What is real? How do we know anything at all? And what's the point of it all? And the answer is one reality, Brahman, which you analyze it a little further. It is being itself, it's consciousness itself, it is bliss itself. These are not components or parts of Brahman. They are the same thing, basically.
And pure, meaning it sits inside of itself. There's nothing outside of it. Pure,
it is
it's
true.
A total. Yeah, it's a.
Yes, it's not mixed. And it's not. For example, when you say pure being, it does not mean that it's a thing. Things exist. So in the universe, you have planets and stars, you have human beings and dogs and cats and all of that. It's not that Brahman is one more thing in this catalog of things. Is it one more thing called Brahman? No. It is that which appears as all things. It's like I give like the example of golden ornaments. So if you go to a jewelry shop, you will see all kinds of ornaments, necklaces, tiaras, and bracelets. And if somebody tells you the reality is gold, you wouldn't go looking for one more ornament in the catalog called gold. You would know that immediately, yes, all of these are gold. Gold is basically all of these. It's in all of these ornaments. And in fact, all of these ornaments depend on the gold for their existence. Like that. In that sense, it's the very essence of reality itself. I mean, it sounds poetic, but one has to become a little poetic when you come to this level of analysis.
Right. Absolutely. And in that, in your system of thought, in Advaita Vedanta, there is a term Maya.
Yes.
Illusion. Could you give us a definition of that? Because I often find that when people come across the non-dual traditions, that sense of illusion can trip them up. And I think also what you're saying is we want to be clear on where the identity comes from.
Right.
So yes, if you could tell us a little bit about Maya.
Mm. And in our system, that's the difficult question. If you talk about ultimate reality, that's easy. People will tell you that's Brahman. It's limitless existence, consciousness, bliss. They will just rattle it off. When it comes to Maya, they will hem and haw and hesitate because that's the difficult one. Yes. Before that, let me just say that the central teaching of Vedanta or Advaita Vedanta, the central teaching, it can be elegantly put in one sentence. You are that. Or in Sanskrit, Tat Tvamasi. Tat means that and Tvam means you, the student, the individual being, sentient being like us. You are that reality. So this Brahman which we are talking about, which sounds awfully abstract and not very clear what it means. But you, the thing which is most familiar to us is ourselves. I, me, myself. Vedanta says, the claim of Advaita Vedanta is, this you are Brahman. You are that limitless existence consciousness. Limitless existence consciousness bliss. Now, the question arises, if I am that, and I am that right now. I have always been that and never anything but that. If that's true, then why don't I feel it? Why does it seem so abstract? Why doesn't it seem obvious to me? If I am that and if everything is that, there Maya comes in. So the Maya is that, it's a power which obstructs our realization of what we truly are and projects that same Brahman, our real nature, as this individual being, as Leanne or Sarvapriyan and the other people, and also as this material world. So Maya does two things. Maya is that power which obscures Brahman, our real nature, and projects it. And it makes it seem as if we are these limited beings and this world, and we inhabiting a separate, different material world. Whereas the truth would be, according to Advaita Vedanta, that it is you are limitless existence, consciousness, bliss right now. And this world, which seems to be a diverse material world, is actually one with you. There is actually an underlying oneness, which is that same Brahman. Why it doesn't seem so, why it seems so difficult to wrap our minds around this? The answer is Maya. It's not negative, because though right now it might seem to be the source of our problems, but when we become enlightened, when we awaken to our real nature, we'll see that Maya is beautiful. It is that which enables us to enjoy Brahman in all these diverse forms. It's what makes life possible.
Yes, and mentioning Song of the Lord, the Bhagavad Gita, that it's a core text of the philosophical system. In love, Bhakti Yoga, the yogas of devotion. Is it possible that we can't wrap our mind around it because the whole body does need to understand it? It's that the heart is a key component to actually the understanding in and of itself.
You are so right. That last part which you said, the heart is a key component. It's so interesting that in the original texts, in the Upanishads, you find they're talking about the intellect, the buddhi, the intellect, which is often referred to as the heart. And we get around it usually by saying, oh, they're talking about the thinking, the understanding. But no, they are very clear about it. So there is a monk recently who visited us, drew this very subtle distinction. When we are using the intellect, we are thinking, we are analyzing, we are trying to understand. But our deepest convictions about ourselves and the world, they are more a matter of the heart than an intellectual conception. So it's quite possible that we may read stuff, listen to lectures, and even understand it intellectually, but not accept it at the heart level. And so what Advaita Vedanta tries to do, or the yoga of knowledge tries to do, is it in fact questions our deepest, most cherished ideas about, most unquestioned ideas about who we are and what this world is, at the deepest possible level, at the most radical level, and tries to change that, tries to correct it. I'll back up a little. You mentioned the yoga of devotion. I mentioned the yoga of knowledge. I think it's good to just put it out there. One way of talking about the paths to become enlightened. So now we have Brahman, the ultimate reality, and Maya, which obscures our knowledge of that ultimate reality, and Vedanta saying that you are that ultimate reality. Now, naturally, the question will come up, how do I realize that? If I am that, in order to realize that, and that would be called awakening or enlightenment, you need paths, you need methods, procedures. And there are many, many, there's a tremendous diversity of views and paths in Hinduism. Broadly, Swami Vivekananda, I think, the founder of the Vedanta Society, where I am seated right now, he's the one who really authentically brought Hinduism to the West in the Chicago Parliament of Religions in 1893. He made an attempt at classifying all these diverse paths of practice into four broad paths. There's the path of knowledge, or the yoga of knowledge. Yoga meaning a path which connects us to the divine or takes us to realization or enlightenment. So there's the yoga of knowledge, in Sanskrit, Jnana Yoga. There's the yoga of devotion, in Sanskrit, Bhakti Yoga. There's the yoga of meditation, in Sanskrit, Raja Yoga or Dhyana Yoga. And then there's the yoga of action, of service, karma yoga. So Vivekananda said by any one of these yogas, one can become enlightened, or by more of these, or by all of these, harmonizing all of these in our lives. So yeah, so these are the paths.
Yeah, many paths. One realization, could we say, because enlightenment, it's an interesting word. Because pure consciousness, it's already there, absolute, the true existence. So it's more of cleaning out the obstructions, or cleaning the lens of perception, the light sitting in itself as consciousness really is already there. So I find enlightenment is an interesting term in and of itself, whereas it's a realization.
Yes.
Do you know where I'm going with that? Do you see where I'm going with that?
Right. Actually, you know, that reminds me of Vivekananda. He said, all that we can do is polish the mirror. Yes, you are right. In one sense, it's a negative approach because you are already that. And so all you have to do is remove the obstruction, that which prevents us from seeing it or realizing it in our lives. In this way of thinking, this whole enlightenment approach is to become enlightened about what we already are and what things already are in their real nature. In the path of knowledge, this would be put in as a moment of intuitive realization, a breakthrough, which would lead to realizing that, oh, I am not this, just this person. The person is there. I'm not just this body or just this mind or this body-mind personality, Sarva Priyananda. I am awareness. I am limitless awareness. I am always fulfilled. I am being itself. I am Brahman, or in Sanskrit, Aham Brahmasmi. So this shift of the identity of the I, what I thought in my deepest, most unexamined, most cherished beliefs, I thought that I was this, and that's all I am. But this is a radical shift which happens, and I realize my real nature, which was always there, and this shift is enlightenment. One Swami, I heard this recently, a monk put it humorously in. He used the word enlightenment in two senses. One is enlightenment in the sense of light, illumination. It dawns upon us. It's like a veil lifting. It's an intuitive flash which you realize, oh, this is what it is. So in that sense, enlightenment. But in the other sense, lightening up, you know, it lightens your burden. Like Jesus says in the gospel, come unto me, ye that are heavy laden. So the burden of life, of samsara, that is gone when you become enlightened. That's the first result of this. You are literally lighter, tremendously so. So yeah, that's an interesting word.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think especially in the US, I don't know if you find this having lived here for a while and taught here, the mind can try to grasp, and grasping after enlightenment isn't really the direction that we want to go. It's a release. The practices are important, and maybe you could speak to that because it is a cleaning of the lens, a purification of the lens. So if consciousness is pure, it sits inside itself, there is no other. It's matching the lens to that, or cleaning the lens so there's a clear view into that. And the practices can be extremely helpful, but not the grasping after enlightenment, just showing up and doing the practices. Can you
Yes,
share more about that?
you are taking it to the subtlest level right now. Let me back up there and just note that the very fact that enlightenment and people are seeking it, and yes, trying to grasp it, all that's actually very encouraging. Because I look back to 100+ years when Vivekananda first came here, and he talked about God realization or self realization. It was basically new to large numbers of people, because most people thought religion meant believing in stuff and trying to be a good person. And then you get your reward at death, or hopefully after death, you go to a nice place, a heaven. Nobody thought too much about it. But that you could make it a living reality in this life, here and now, and live spirituality, that was either not even considered as an option, or maybe people who thought about it thought it's just for a special category of people, you know, saints maybe, not for the majority of people, but that everybody can and should be spiritual, can and should aspire for self-realization, God-realization, enlightenment, whatever you call it. This has become mainstream in America now over the last 100+ years, and that is very encouraging. That is tremendously encouraging. It's a silent revolution. I mean, to have thousands and millions of people honestly, sincerely seeking after enlightenment, what a great thing that is. And not just seeking after money or pleasure or power or entertainment, seeking after enlightenment. In India, since the most ancient times, this has been seen as the acme of civilization, that the ultimate goal of life, why we are here, why this universe is here, the best thing that one can aspire for, the noblest life that one can lead. This is it, this the search for enlightenment.
Okay,
Having said that, but what you are pointing to is a subtle point. Now you have all these paths. And so people, we set out on this with vigor and enthusiasm, like we have been pursuing a degree, like we have been pursuing trying to become rich or set up a relationship and bring up a family or whatever. We look upon this as one more project. Now, that's not bad. It keeps us on track and turning up for the practice. If it's your meditation practice, your devotional practices, your philosophical inquiries into who am I. But what you said is, at its core, there is always the possibility of a huge, huge misunderstanding. The misunderstanding is this, that there is something unachieved which I have to achieve. There is something that I have to reach. Some tremendous change that has to come around here, and that would be enlightenment. Now, it's not that it's not an attainment, it's not that it's not a transformation, those things will happen. But at its core, it's not that. We say in Vedanta, spirituality is not a journey from one place to, you know, it's not from here to somewhere, you know, like a heaven or some other world. It's not a journey in space, not going somewhere. It's not a journey in time, not from now to some other time, you know, after death or after the coming of the next avatar or messiah or somebody, or after I get samadhi, you know, meditative absorption. No, after that. It's not a journey in time. It's not even a journey from I, me, myself to something else. It's not a journey from one object to another, from the subject to some other object. No, it's right here, it's right now, and it is you. When we do become enlightened, we will not say that, now I have got it. There is this Brahman which I did not have and now I have got it. Done, I can tick the box. No, we will see it was always there. It was blindingly obvious, and somehow by this incredible thing, that's why it's called Maya, I never really saw this. So that would be enlightenment. Why is it like that? I mean, I can make it even more precise. Why is it like that? Why does this problem come of grasping? It's because of this. I always love this story. I always tell this story at this point. The old Indian story of the 10th man. So these 10 friends cross a river. And after having crossed a river, they think, did we all cross or did somebody drown? Are we all here? And they start counting. One of them counts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Oh my God, where's the 10th man? And they count, let me count. And they all find 9 people. But obviously, they're not counting themselves. And they start crying, and the 10th man is dead. Our friend has drowned. And a wise man passes by and says, why are you crying, my friends? And they say, look, we crossed the river and our friend drowned. How do you know? Well, there were 10 of us and there are 9 now. How do you know? We counted, sir. And so this man must have realized what was going on. And he said, don't cry. The 10th man is there. This is where the guru comes. Our spiritual traditions tell us, don't cry. It is all right. It's going to be all right. They say, how? Well, I'll show you. Count. They say, we counted. Humor me. Count again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I told you 9 people. And this man comes and turns the counter's hand around and says, 10. You are the 10. In Sanskrit, dashamastvamasi. You are the 10th. And this man goes, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Oh, 10. I found it. I found the 10th person. And they all try counting and they all find the 10th person. They're very happy. Now, that's a very profound story as far as self-realization goes. If you ask, why didn't they find the 10th man? And immediately the answer would be, because they didn't count themselves. They counted others. Now, the next question would be, why did they not count themselves? Why did they count only the others? The reason is because everybody else is outside. The first 9 are other. You can count them separately. And your tendency comes in the mind to look for the 10th man outside. It's a very reasonable tendency. I found those 9 guys outside. The 10th guy also should be outside. He should be standing there. I should be able to count that guy. All our lives, the only kind of knowing, the only kind of experiencing we are used to is of objects, of people, of places, of gadgets, of movies, of, you know, even subtle, when we look inwards, when we introspect, of thoughts, of feelings, of ideas, memories. These are all the nine persons. They're all objects. Even what we call insight is an object. The definition of an object is what you are aware of. Simple and elegant definition. Anything that you can experience. Have you experienced God? It's an object. If you have experienced it. So anything that you can experience is an object. But what we forget all the time, there is something that is experiencing all of this. Something that is illumining all of this. Something to which all of this is appearing. Someone to whom the nine are appearing. And that one is not one of those nine. That one is not outside. That one you can't objectify as, you know, nine and ten out there. You can't do that. The result is, in our spiritual life also, we keep doing that. So we are now looking for, okay, I'm not the mind, I'm peaceful, I'm quiet and calm. Now we wait for Brahman, Atman, the Buddha nature, something to come. And it never comes. It cannot, because it's already there. It's that which is illumining your whole spiritual practice. You are it. The only way you can do it is that subtle turn. 10, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That intuitive turn, that self-reflexive is a dirty word in philosophy, so you can't use it, but that inward turn, let us say, somebody put it very beautifully, it's a U-turn, a Y-O-U-turn, not a U-turn, but a Y-O-U-turn, a U-turn or a me-turn. Once you've got it, you've got it. Vivekananda used to say that, you know, you've seen these trick pictures. So it looks like a mass of dots, but somebody tells you that it's a forest with a tiger hidden behind it. And you look and look and look, and then suddenly you see the face of the tiger. And once you've seen it, you can't miss it. The next time somebody shows it to you, you immediately see it. Right in that way, once you've seen it in the sense, quote unquote, I am that awareness, always have been and will be, then you can't miss it. And then it's done. But all the practices, whether it's devotion, whether it is meditation, whether it's self-inquiry, indeed even selfless engagement with society, they are very helpful.
And just to make this point again, what I hear you saying is the distinction between the seer and the seen, or the distinction between awareness and what we're aware of, between pure consciousness and the contents of consciousness. Because a lot of time in Euro-American culture, we think thoughts are consciousness.
Yes.
Whereas what you're really bringing home here is this distinction between the pure awareness and anything you can see or perceive. If it's perceivable, at least for a time on the journey, then you want to put those in different categories, because that's, you want to get that distinction down. And once you've gotten that distinction down, maybe the next part of the path shows itself.
Right. That's a lot to unpack what you just said. The seer and the seen, that's one way of doing it. In the first pass at this, we see that it's very clear we are not the world. It's common sense. I'm not the table. I'm not the computer. Even though I can see my face in the computer, I am not the computer. I'm not even that face in the computer. They're all objects to me. But when it comes to the body, we fumble there, because we can say it's my body. It's an object. I can see it. And yet sometimes I say, I am this. So that's where the Vedantic analysis really takes root. First of all, we work on the sense of identification with the body, and we see the body is as much a thing as the table and the chair and the computer. And then we go further. As you said, in our thoughts, in our modern thinking, especially in the Western world, we think consciousness and mind are the same thing. In fact, if you look at consciousness studies, which is very hot, hot topic among academicians, scientists, computer scientists today, consciousness studies, what they are actually studying is the mind. So when they talk about consciousness studies, they're talking about thoughts and perceptions and memory and pain and pleasure, sense of ego. All of this is the mind. Someone might ask, how would you distinguish? Remember the criterion which I mentioned earlier. Anything that you can become aware of is a thing, is an object. It's not awareness. So can I become aware of my own thoughts? Of course one can. That's what is called introspection. You can analyze, you can look into your own thoughts. When we look into our own thoughts, thoughts are objects too. And that is not consciousness. It's an appearance to consciousness as much as a rock is, as much as a table is. A table or a rock are solid, external objects, or what were called in Sanskrit sthula, gross objects. And thoughts and perceptions, ideas, memories, these are called subtle objects. But they are objects nevertheless. They are not consciousness. In this way, when we come to a clarity about what consciousness is, for example, a very subtle point here. Consciousness is the witness of all thoughts, of all subtle and gross objects. At this point, someone might think, or someone might ask, isn't it just the mind thinking? Why are you making a distinction between mind and consciousness? Isn't it the mind thinking about itself? When you're thinking, oh, I am the witness of this thought, that's also a thought. That's not there's no such thing as a separate witness or a consciousness. The answer would be, even when you are not thinking about it, even when you are not doing any spirituality, you're just involved in life, you are working or relaxing or whatever, and have not the slightest idea of spiritual inquiry in your mind, at that time also you are aware. At that time also, even when we are not thinking about awareness, we are not even thinking about the mind, you're still aware. Still it's a conscious experience. So it's not the mind thinking about itself. Suppose when the mind stops thinking, Vedanta would go so far as to say, when the mind stops thinking in deep meditation or in deep sleep, or go further in anesthesia, or go further in coma, Vedanta would say, you're still as conscious as you are right now. Only the objects of consciousness have disappeared. That's why it seems to be a complete blank. So in the first stage, as you said, in the first stage of the Vedantic inquiry, one needs to appreciate awareness or consciousness for what it is. I am that. Bare awareness or bare consciousness. But then the second path comes. So the second stage of the path, let us say, opens up. That's a big, here I would make a distinction between the Sankhya and the Yoga philosophy and the non-dual Advaita philosophy. The Sankhya and the Yoga philosophy are primarily dualistic. They will stop here. You are awareness. Everything else is an object to you. Everything else they'll put under the umbrella of Prakriti or nature. And you are awareness, they call it Purusha, consciousness itself. That's it, it's done. Now you have to live it. Vedanta would still ask a further question. Vedanta would say, well, what's the relationship between you, the bare awareness, consciousness, Atman, whatever you call it, and all these objects? This mind, this body, this world, what are they in relation to you, the consciousness? Are they really separate, or are they one with you in some way? And Vedanta comes to that latter conclusion, that actually what we separated ourselves from in our quest for pure consciousness, and we found it, what pure consciousness is. Now when we look back upon the world and the body and the mind, we realize these are all the radiance of that same consciousness. It's actually one reality, not two distinct realities. Not a spiritual reality and a material reality. Rather, the whole of it is a spiritual reality. This is non-dualism, because there is no duality. There is no duality of spirit and matter. There is no duality of subject and object. It is the subject itself which appears as its own object.
Right, right. Again, so sitting inside itself. A lot of people do get put off by the term pure. But for me, it just means there is no other. It's pure because it sits inside itself. And I just want to share with you, I'm a long time studier of yoga, and I've read many, many translations. But one of the first translations I ever read was Four Chapters on Freedom by Swami Saraswati. And he actually reads yoga through a more Vedantic, Advaita Vedantic lens. So he actually sees yoga in a non-dual way. And I went on to read several other scholars who also see yoga that way. And just one thing I'll say here is, like, the final sutra 434, where Patanjali uses the feminine gender, he talks about Shakti and consciousness sitting inside itself. So there are scholars out there, not all of them. I think when you, from the Orthodox Hindu perspective, yoga and Sankhya are almost seen as, I know they're separate schools, there's the six orthodox Hindu philosophies. Sankhya and yoga are definitely distinguished, but it's often paired with Sankhya as like a radical dualism. But again, one of my first teachers or the first book I read sees it more through of a Advaita Vedantic lens.
Absolutely. Swami Vivekananda, when he came to the West here in 1893, then he came to New York in 1894. Later on, he went on to write his first book, which is Raja Yoga, which is his commentary on the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. And he does exactly that. He takes a Vedantic reading of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, not a radical dualism, though he acknowledges that, but the way he chooses to interpret it is as a oneness. That has been done. You're right. Though technically Sankhya and Yoga share the same dualistic worldview, often yogic meditation has been paired with Vedantic non-dual philosophy. So Vedantic non-dualists will often use yogic meditation techniques. Once you have studied it, once you have a clarity that I am this awareness, still the mind has to be tuned to it and has to be, let's put it this way, soaked in it, in this new clarity. Then only the actual work of transformation at the mental level takes place. Look, in one sense, the material world is the material world. Atman, Brahman, pure consciousness is fine. But the problem is the conjunction of the two. We are at this junction of I am pure consciousness, but also right now, I cannot deny that I am embodied. There is a body. I may not be the body, but there is a body. There is a personality and there is a life to be lived. I may realize I am limitless consciousness, but then I will still have to come back and lead this life. There's this nice saying, I think, in spiritual life, you have to go away, but you have to come back to. So you can go away to Atman, Brahman, all you want, but you have to come back to Liam and Sarva Priyananda and the lives that we lead. Now, the test is this, that going away, can you bring back that light, the Promethean fire, back into this life? Vedanta and Madhyamaka Buddhism, or some schools of Mahayana, most schools of Mahayana Buddhism, make this distinction between two levels of truth. The absolute truth, which in this case would be Brahman, Atman, pure being, pure consciousness, and the relative truth, which would be this life, body, mind, world, work, enjoyment, suffering, life, death. This is relative truth. Now, if we confine ourselves to the relative truth, which most people do, because there's no inkling of anything higher, it leads straight to materialism, and it leads to samsara, it leads to suffering, and that's where we are. But if you try to confine yourself only to the absolute truth, then one tends to neglect this the manifestation, which is a manifestation of the absolute. So you're taking one side of the absolute and neglecting the other side of the absolute. One great Tibetan Buddhist master, Tsongkhapa, he noted, he was talking about the monks in the Tibetan plateau about 500 years ago, those who dwelt too much on emptiness. He said it. He noted that it led to a metaphysical nihilism, that nothing exists. It led to skepticism in knowledge, you know, doubting everything, and it led to a relativity in ethics, a looseness in monastic life. So the importance of both, of going away, of realizing that you are Brahman, and then coming back and shedding light, using that illumination to live a much better life here. Tremendously transformed, at least inner transformation.
I'm so glad that you brought up the ethics. Because again, as a long-term follower of Patanjali Yoga, the yamas, I mean, the non-violence, truth, non-stealing. Ethics are a really important path. Part of the yogic or Vedanta path when it comes to, again, cleaning the lens of perception. That, could we call it an alignment? Alignment between the functional organizing principle or alignment with the lens, with the light. Something like that. It's an alignment from the more gross or the embodied nature in with the pure consciousness. It's relational, I think, is another way we could say it. The mind is embodied and it is relational. The nervous system is such an important part of pranayama and yoga asana. Again, key practices on the path, because our nervous system is also indicative of the comfortable seat that we're taking in the body, which allows us to... and maybe you could share your point of view on that. I would say that taking the comfortable seat, and now we're talking about potentially like 246, 247, 248, taking a comfortable seat in the body, he says, is beyond the dualities. Now we're beyond the dualities. So there is something very relational, ultimately, I think. And to get caught in the nihilism is really... maybe it's a turn of certain schools of Vedanta. I'm not sure. It's not my preferred turn. So I love where this conversation is going.
First and foremost, as you mentioned, the importance of ethics. To put it bluntly, no God without good. So without goodness, you can't have spirituality. Ethics first, the groundwork of ethics first, and then spiritual life. One can't skip over that particular step. So you have the yamas and niyamas in the Ashtanga Yoga of Patanjali. In Vedanta, we have the fourfold qualification, in which they talk about the six treasures, shama, dhamma, which is basically control of the mind, control of the senses, disciplining of the body, mind, especially the nervous system, as you mentioned. Because it's one continuum, one can't, if you don't take care of it at this end, and you want to take care of it only at that end, it won't work. This will disturb us so much that will never allow us to go there or settle down there. And even if someone does, through study and practice, get an intuition of the truth, call it pure consciousness or I am Brahman, whatever it is. But if the ethical side of it has not been taken care of, to a great extent, you know, to a high level of excellence, it will prevent us from manifesting that intuition, from living it. So first of all, on our journey towards enlightenment or towards the higher reaches of the spiritual mountain, lack of ethics will prevent us from going there at all. And if by some way we manage to reach something, we get some genuine breakthrough, lack of ethics, that means, and here I'm talking about not immoral people or bad people, just good people who haven't taken enough care to be even better. So that will prevent us from manifesting that realization. That's why you hear about these yogis, these gurus or spiritual masters who suddenly, they seem to morally slip from the spiritual path. A gap seems to open up between what they are claiming and to be and what they actually are in their lives. It's not that it's false what they claim to be. They might genuinely have had breakthroughs. This has been known in India from ancient times. Just because one has a samadhi, just because one has a vision of the truth, doesn't mean the journey is complete. Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Vivekananda's guru, often would say, go forward, go forward. He gave the example of a woodcutter whose guru told him, go deeper into the forest. And then this poor woodcutter finds a forest of sandalwood, which is very expensive, becomes rich. But then he realized that the guru didn't tell him to stop there. He said, go forward. And he goes forward and he finds a silver mine, then he finds a gold mine, then he finds a diamond mine. But these are metaphors for to push forward in spiritual life. So ethical foundation is absolutely important there. Yamas and niyamas are the disciplines of Advaita Vedanta, the preliminary disciplines. No God without the good.
Yeah. Yes. Very, very important. There's many aspects, right? Because you hear non-duality or I am that, but without a deep study of the system of thought, then these finer points can get missed.
Right.
And you can't co-opt it. You can't just co-opt I am that. And that's why the nervous system, the comfortable seat in the body, again, the identity doesn't want to be with the body, but the body can give indications, I think we could say, or the purity of the heart, the goodness that you're saying, the service to the world. the ability to be truthful or
absolutely you're absolutely right. So on this path, you know, one can convince oneself, especially on the Advaitic path, not so much on the yogic path. On the yogic path, there's a lot to be done. It's the progressive stages of development. On the Advaitic path, one might just listen to talks and read a few books and sit quietly for a while. And within weeks, months, or within a few years, think that I'm enlightened. I've got it. I am pure consciousness. Then what happens is the results are not good. Either life teaches us, life is a hard taskmaster. So we get enough kicks and blows in life and we realize it isn't working. Whatever I thought I was, I'm this pure consciousness. But no, I'm still the same old, somebody said, you're still the same dude. So I react in the same way to life. When people are nasty to me, I react with anger or unhappiness. When there is physical pain, when there are problems around me, I react with the same suffering and grumbling and complaining. And that shows me what I thought of as spirituality did not work. Because the claim of spirituality is, or Advaita Vedanta claims, it transcends, helps you to transcend suffering, helps you to attain fulfillment. If I'm clearly not able to transcend my personal suffering, if I'm clearly not feeling fulfilled, something did not work. And if I feel that, that's good. It's a blessing from life. It's an indicator that I have to be up and doing and, you know, follow that. Go forward. What might happen, what's worse, what might happen sometimes and does happen is a new term for it, spiritual bypassing.
Yes.
So some time may be lost, valuable time may be lost into, when I fool myself into thinking, I'm fine. Things are good. I'm enlightened, or I'm very close at least. I don't tell anybody, but internally I believe that I am enlightened. And so it's good. My state of mind matches what the books say. No. It's best not to claim enlightenment, even if you're enlightened. And it's dangerous to claim enlightenment when you are not enlightenment. Even if you're spiritually very advanced, if you say that, no, I'm just a seeker. And I'm on the path just like everybody else. No harm is done. You go ahead on your path and you are helpful to others. On the other hand, if I say that, well, I am enlightened and I'm not, then that stops my further progress and I can delude myself and I can actually cause harm to others also, people who might be taken in by my conviction because I do believe it. And so I speak with strength and conviction. And of course, what I'm speaking about, it's the message of the Upanishads. It's the message of the Yoga Sutras, of the Bhagavad Gita. It's the truth, actually. It's the deepest truth about everybody. So if I, even without being enlightened, even without being sufficiently spiritually advanced, if I just talk the talk, and I talk it convincingly, because it is the truth at some deep level, people respond to it. But then they see the shortcomings. They see that this person, there's a great difference between this person's life and the talk he talks. And that's very shocking to a lot of people.
Yes, I actually, by degree, I'm a Jungian depth psychologist, and I don't know if you're familiar with Carl Jung at all, but shadow work is a big part of what we do in depth psychology, to always be aware of the personal shadow, where our own misunderstandings or ignorance lie. Jung encouraged people absolutely to study Eastern thought, but never to move the intuitive self or to grasp after further than one's own development of one's shadow. And at least in yoga, the samskaras, the vasanas, the habit patterns of the mind, and it's interesting because we have to be aware of those habit patterns. And it does seem that spiritual bypass is also possible. So then like a dissociation happens, and that's, we don't want that either. So it's always the willingness to be aware. Oh, look at that. Yeah, my repetitive anger or my repetitive jealousy, or if there's any, again, vasanas, samskaras, or we would call them complexes in depth psychology. It's being aware and owning up and being able to transform or gain insight into those patterns, because ultimately they can be integrated, but you have to see it first. You have to be aware.
And if we do suffer and if the universe does send us these messages, they are blessings, actually. I mean, they can be shocking because they show that I have not really there yet. I have not progressed as much as I thought. I thought I was an enlightened Jivan Mukta, a Buddha in the making. I am not. I'm still the same dude. That can be shocking and disappointing, but it's a blessing, really. It opens up the door to keep on working on myself and make genuine progress. At least I'm at it. I'm on the path, and this is the finest, the best thing that one can, the path that one can work on.
Yeah, that's a great frame. So I do want to take us into that idea of the Ritambara Prajna, because I know we're getting towards the close here. If you could offer the definition of Ritambara, then also Prajna.
Prajna, it means wisdom. Here, wisdom of one's own spiritual self, one's own spiritual nature, and the nature of all things. Let me speak about the corresponding idea of final, fullest enlightenment from the Advaitic perspective. It is called Brahmakara Vritti. Brahmakara Vritti means the final moment of realization, of enlightenment, of the nature of Brahman. Vritti is knowledge, whatever experience we are having, like Chitta Vritti, for example. So whatever is going on in the mind, that's a Vritti. But this is a special Vritti, which comes through long inquiry into who am I, the inquiry into the Advaitic texts. We realize that I'm not the body, I'm not the prana, I'm not the mind or the intellect. I am awareness itself. And then this awareness, this is what shines forth as the mind, intellect, prana, body, and indeed the entire universe. The whole universe is one with this awareness which I am. This final non-dual realization, in Sanskrit it is called Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. This is called Brahmakara Vritti, which is the corresponding thing to Ritambara Prajna there. Then one realizes that this Brahman is the reality. The world is its shadow or appearance, and I am that Brahman. How is this different from any other kind of knowing? Is it like any other kind of seeing, thinking? No, it's very different. The difference, the precise technical difference is this. In ordinary knowing, so suppose I'm seeing this book, I'm looking at this book. So light comes and falls on the book and is reflected to my eyes, and then it's processed through the optic nerves, goes to the brain. Somehow, nobody knows yet how, even latest neuroscience can't tell us. The last final subtle processings in the brain are somehow presented to the mind. And in the mind, it sets up a vritti about that book. And there is consciousness in the mind. Pure consciousness is reflected in the mind, and this reflected consciousness in the mind illumines that vritti, the vritti about the book. And I have the experience, I know this book, or I see this book. Oh, that's a book. So this is knowledge. This is the way we have ordinary knowledge. We see, hear, smell, taste, touch. We think, we remember, we understand. All of it is this, a vritti in the mind illumined by the reflected consciousness, the consciousness which is pure consciousness, which is channeled or reflected in the mind. Now, what is this Brahmakara Vritti, the moment of enlightenment? Here is where it all becomes very clear, this objectifying tendency. One might think that, so instead of a book, now I know Brahman. Earlier I was knowing a book, I was seeing this book. Now it is somehow, in place of the book, there will be Brahman, and there will be a Vritti about Brahman, and the consciousness in the mind will reveal Brahman, and I know Brahman. That's not what is going to happen. All our spiritual practices, our meditations, our inquiries will attune the mind in such a way that it's sort of aligned with our real nature. And our real nature illumines that aligned mind. It does not wait for the mind to illumine. It's like one beautiful example is the moon and the earth and the sun. So at night, it is the moon which illumines the earth. We see things in the world because of moonlight. But the moonlight is reflected sunlight. And the moon is like the mind. In fact, in Vedanta, moon is the symbol for the mind. And the sun is the symbol for pure consciousness. So it's sunlight reflected from the moon, which illumines the world at night as moonlight. But now suppose it's a solar eclipse. So what happens in a solar eclipse is the moon comes between the earth and the sun. And the sunlight falls on the moon, but it does not, it's not getting reflected to the earth. Rather, it's reflected back towards the sun. Now, would you say the moonlight is illumining the sun? No. The sunlight is illumining the moon, and the sunlight is illumining everything, including the sun itself. The sun is what is called self-luminous in that sense. So, at the moment of Brahmakara Vritti in Ritambhara Prajna. There are technical differences, but I won't go into this. It's like the moon reflecting the sunlight back, not towards the earth, but back towards the sun. That reflected light does not illumine the sun. The sun reveals itself. So our real nature, pure consciousness, reveals itself, as indeed it is doing all the time, but we don't see it. The whole point of spiritual practice, both meditation and inquiry, is to align the mind in such a way, it's like the moon reflecting sunlight back to the sun. And it's not the reflected sunlight from the moon which reveals the sun, but the sun revealing itself, shining forth with a million times more light than the moon can possibly reflect back. This is a good example. Having realized that, then one has to, of course, live it. Post Ritambara Prajna, post Brahmakara Vritti.
Wonderful explanation using the sun and the moon. I often teach that way myself. I think it's a great way to use nature to explain and bring the metaphor about. Is there something to the cosmic order in that? Rhythm. What is the definition of rhythm?
Rhythm, yes. Rhythm has multiple meanings, but what you are referring to is a Vedic use of the term rhythm, which means cosmic order. So, yes, this world is the manifestation of Brahman, but that's not the end of the story. There is something of that ultimate reality reflected in the world, in the way nature functions, in the way our bodies function, in the way our minds function. And the more we live our lives according to that cosmic order or rhythm, the more we are in harmony with nature, with our lives, with our own karma, the easier it is to become spiritually enlightened. And the more we are in dissociation with or in denial of this flow of nature, of this flow of this universe, the order of the universe, the more, disharmonious our living is at the physical level, at the pranic level, at our thoughts. And that leads to all sorts of problems. At the physical level, it might lead to diseases. At the mental level, it might lead to emotional upheavals and unhappiness. At the intellectual level, it leads to a wrong idea about what I am and what the world is. So all these problems come about. That rhythm is, translation would be cosmic order or cosmic harmony. That's the reflection of the ultimate reality in the mirror of the universe, let's say.
And it's also reminding me, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi would often teach a certain Veda where what's disclosed, because again, that's Shruti, which we didn't go into, but that perhaps for another time, this idea of seeing, again, it's perceiving. Knowledge is structured in consciousness.
Yes.
So wisdom, intelligence, knowledge, guidance. I don't know if there's anything further to say there, because, again, as a longtime follower of Patanjali, chapter 3, Vibhutipada, you know, the capacity to see through non-dual perception, clairaudience, clairvoyance. So there's a way beyond dualistic eyesight, so to speak, again, that object. Now you're, right. I think it's Anubhava or a vision from the inside. Now you're sort of inside. As we close out here, I don't know if there's anything you could add.
That's a beautiful way of closing it. It's because it's embodying that wisdom. It's true. In the Yoga Sutras, you talk about Ritambhara Prajna, about Viveka Khyati, the ultimate breakthroughs which you get in spiritual life, and you realize your pure consciousness. In Vedanta, you talk about Brahmakara Vritti, the realization that I am Brahman. That's all good, and that's the whole point of spiritual life. However, as you said, the rishis of the Shrutis means that which was heard. The Vedas are called Shruti because originally it was transmitted orally from the teacher to the student, to a lineage of masters and students. They speak about many things. It's not just about the realization, I am consciousness and that's it. That would be very minimalistic. But there are lots of things that the Vedas speak about. They speak about a cosmic prana. They speak about an ocean of this physical universe, an ocean of matter, an ocean of prana, an ocean of mind. There's a cosmic mind. And what they're doing is, there are spiritual truths behind all of that, behind life in nature, behind matter in nature, behind our speech, behind our sensory activities, behind the prana coursing through these bodies. So there are spiritual truths there. And as you put it beautifully, the non-dual seeing. Yes, I am non-dual Brahman. But when I bring that those eyes, that vision back to this world, and when I see people and life, prana, and questions of health and sickness, I get a whole new vision and insight into it. Let me give an example. Ayurveda, they're all allied systems. Ayurveda, which is literally the science of life or science of lifespans, ancient Indian medical systems, they say what appears as physical problems has a deeper root in the prana and the pranic level. So instead of treating it treating the body, you treat the prana. What appears as a problem in the prana has emotional levels at the level of the mind. What appears as emotional problems at the level of the mind has intellectual roots, some disorder, some misunderstanding about oneself and life. So they talk about vijnana dosha, a defect at the level of your understanding, your philosophy of life, which could manifest as a disease in the body. So you see this whole thing, which can manifest as something that a doctor can treat at the level of the body, but it has a pranic root. What has a pranic, the problem at the pranic level has a mental root, emotional root. What is the problem at the emotional level has an intellectual root. These are the koshas or the sheets of our personality. There is the food sheet, annamaya kosha. You can fix it with diet. There is a pranic sheet, which is more subtle and powerful, which is the vital forces which make this body alive. There is a what's called manomaya kosha, a mental or emotional sheath. And then there is a vijnanamaya kosha, and a sheath of intellect and understanding. As you said, the heart, our most cherished understandings of ourselves. A problem at that level can manifest as huge emotional upheavals in our life. And it can manifest as sickness in the body and in the prana. So these are the insights which you get when you bring that ultimate spiritual realization. That's great. But when you bring it back to life, you get insights across a whole range of things.
Wonderful. And when the culture is sitting inside that dualistic frame, you can get a plethora of problems. And so, yes, as we close here, is there anything you would like to leave any of the listeners or viewers with who might not have the faith to walk the path of Advaita? Because it does take faith, especially, thankful to teachers like yourself who have really been spreading the teachings of Advaita Vedanta across the Western world or through Euro-American culture. Your work has become very extensive, which is beautiful. And of course, there's many others like you. It does take a leap for those of us who haven't been awakened, so to speak, or haven't been realized, who weren't brought up inside a culture that understands, Brahman as pure consciousness and the non-dual reality. Is there any top tips for any listeners or viewers who might not have that faith?
Yes, and it's not entirely necessary. One of the key teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, who was Swami Vivekananda's guru, is in Bengali, he used to say, Jato mot tato pat. As many fates, so many paths. So the core thing is to be connected to spirituality in whatever way possible. Advaita might not suit you, but maybe a devotional path will suit you. Maybe a meditative path will suit you. Maybe a more active way of selflessly doing good to others will suit you more. It'll come more naturally to you. But in any way possible, be connected to the divine. Sri Ramakrishna is to further say, you set up a whole set of zeros, the total is still zero. But if you put one before the zeros, every zero has a value, it's 10 or 100 or 1,000. And that one is spirituality, in whichever form. If you are devout, a devout Christian, very good, well and good. Catch hold of the Christ, catch hold of God. If you are spiritual but not religious, well and good. Have a meditative practice in your life, have a devotional practice in your life, and so on. So that's one thing, that multiple paths can take you to that divine. Remember the one and the zeros. So have that one in our lives. Let's have that one in our lives in whichever way possible. Catch hold of that one. A second thing I would like to suggest is also comes from Vivekananda, is a good spiritual life, a balanced, wholesome, and effective spiritual life generally should have these four components. A knowledge component, philosophical inquiry, Vedantic inquiry. A meditative component. At least twice in a day, shut out the world and stay by yourself. I think it was Pascal who said most of the problems of humanity come from man's inability to sit quietly in a room by himself. So, a meditative practice. Third, a devotional practice. If you believe in God, you're blessed. So have love or an adoration for God. A relationship, set up a relationship with God. And a practice of karma, of active service. Let my life be of benefit to others without asking for anything in return. Some part of my life, some part of my money, my energy, my sympathies, at least a few kind words to somebody, at least hold back those bitter words of judgment. Somewhere of being of service to others. I put it this way. Somebody said, can you put it without religious overtones? One way is put it this way. Selfless, not selfish, that's karma yoga. Concentration, not distraction, that's raja yoga. Love, not desire, that's bhakti yoga. And knowledge of the self, not just knowledge of others, that's jnana yoga.
Wonderful, wonderful. Swamiji, thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge and wisdom with us today. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Likewise.
And thank you to all of you watching and listening. Thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we're here in community, exploring our common unity.
You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday.
You are warmly invited to visit transformationandintegration.com to access additional resources that support the journey through deep transformation and to learn more about the ongoing offerings at Center for Transformation and Integration, including our certified training in transformational coaching with an emphasis in somatic integration therapy. I look forward to welcoming you there.